Welcome to An Examined Education, a podcast recorded at the Cambridge School, a Christian classical school in San Diego, California, where we examine an education worth pursuing. On today's episode, you'll hear a speech from me that I gave in front of the larger Cambridge community about how we approach literature at the Cambridge School. I walk through the distinction that we make between literature as artifact and literature as experience, and I hope that we leave with some pretty practical takeaways on not only how you might approach literature, but how Cambridge is unique in its interacting with these great classical works. And stay tuned for a longer conversation that Jeff and I have about literature and rhetoric and all things humanities at the Cambridge School. Without further ado, me. Okay, thank you. I think you know the structure of tonight. I'm going to talk a little bit about literature at the Cambridge School. Thought that maybe this is obviously a presentation that is associated with the presentation or the discussion that we're all going to have a few weeks from now. For those of you who have picked up Fahrenheit 451 or want to pick up Fahrenheit 451, it's a book that our eighth graders read. And so if you're interested in joining in a conversation with us, we're going to have the upper school literature faculty here. We're going to talk about the book a little bit as a group, and then we're going to break up and we're going to just have a discussion, not unlike what our upper school students would have, hopefully. So just come ready to discuss. We might ask some questions, but otherwise it'll be kind of free-flowing conversation, and then we can bring it back. The title, Combustible Data, though, does come from Fahrenheit 451, and I thought it would be appropriate to just contextualize this a little bit. It's not spoiling anything, I promise, but one of my favorite moments in the book comes from the kind of main conversation relatively early on between the antagonist and the protagonist. And the antagonist is, as you would expect in a dystopian work, very knowledgeable of the kind of the way things are, and yet doesn't really care and kind of continues in his dystopian ways. And he's having this conversation, and I'm just going to read you a little bit here to contextualize what we mean by combustible data. He says this. He says, if you don't want a house built, hide the nails and wood. If you don't want a man unhappy politically, don't give him two sides to a question to worry him. Give him one. Better yet, give him none. Let him forget there is such a thing as war. If the government is inefficient, top-heavy, and tax-mad, better it be all those than that people worry over it. Give the people contests they win by remembering the words to more popular songs or the names of state capitals or how much corn Iowa grew last year. Cram them full of non-combustible data. Chalk them so full of facts they feel stuffed, but absolutely brilliant with information. Then they'll feel their thinking. They'll get a sense of motion without moving, and they'll be happy because facts of that sort don't change. Don't give them any slippery stuff like philosophy or sociology to tie things up with. That way lies melancholy. So I guess one of the things that I hope that we do here at Cambridge is we give students combustible data, something that is worth learning, that is worth discussing. And so tonight, that's one of the things we're going to do. Just a couple of qualifiers here, and then I promise we'll get started. One, this does kind of speak somewhat broadly to the way we approach literature at Cambridge, although the focus definitely tonight is on the upper school, 7 through 12. I've taught as low as fifth grade, and I'm in conversation with grammar school students, so I'm happy to answer other questions as best I can at the end if you're interested in some of those things. But the idea here will be really focusing on 7 through 12, and even primarily within that subset, within the rhetoric school specifically, which is where I spend most of my time now. So you have in your slides, again, you can't really see this, I imagine, but here's our outline for tonight. So you kind of have a good sense of how much longer you have to sit in these chairs as we go along. I'll kind of clearly markate where we are in the presentation. And again, you can watch along on the your handouts there. The first thing we're going to talk about is Christian education, talk about some of the theological assumptions that are kind of foundational to our approach. We'll talk about approaching literature, get a little bit more practical, thinking about what it looks like in the classroom day in and day out, and then we'll end with some concluding statements. We'll talk a little bit about some of the distinctives that hopefully you've picked up by that point, and then we'll have some Q&A as we need to. So the list that you're going to have here is something that I've kind of come up with in conversation with other people at the school. This is by no means an exhaustive set of assumptions that we hold to as a school that is both Christian and classical. But I think that they're going to have some pretty important impacts on the way that we understand how we approach literature here. So I'm going to go through these kind of four characteristics of what I think are kind of essential to a Christian education. And again, I'm happy to kind of hear more from you. But I also don't want this to be an exhaustive list by any means. So the first one is understanding that Christian education speaks to Christian as a noun first and foremost, not an adjective, which is to say that it is an education that is done by Christians. And I think that has a lot of kind of significant impacts, that your students are in a room interacting with all of this combustible data with other believers who share these theological assumptions and can kind of operate on that bandwidth in a way that perhaps in other schools they may not have. And so I think that's the kind of foundational and indeed primary way in which Christian education is distinct. And in fact, sometimes we will, you know, for your sakes, for your students who are thinking, you know, how does one do something Christianly? How does one read literature Christianly? How does one teach Christianly? Hopefully they see that every day because their teachers are Christians. And so we try to model that in a lot of ways that I think are pretty important. We're going to return back to this point, I think, in some important ways a little bit later on. Secondly, we have a realistic and theologically informed anthropology. We take scripture pretty seriously when it speaks to the nature of humanity, particularly humans who are living after the fall, but in this kind of common grace arena. So we are broken. We are sinful by nature. We are covered with guilt and shame so much. And yet, we are also dignified. We are noble and ennobled by the image that we bear, as Genesis 1, 26, 27 talks about. Which is, again, significant because it's not just us who are broken and yet dignified, but it's also the authors that we read. It's the conversation partners that we have in the classroom. It's our colleagues, right? So believer or unbeliever, this is a universal truth of all mankind after the fall and before the resurrection, which I think is, again, significant to think about. Related to that, people are complicated. Characters, then, in our novels are complicated. And that is part of our anthropology. That is part of the assumption that we go into thinking about our authors, thinking about the characters that they are wielding, thinking about our narrators, and again, thinking about our conversation partners around the literature table, that there's this web of complications that we have to kind of interact with. And that really invites this kind of charitable reading and charitable interaction, again, with text and friend alike. So we don't really look at kind of characterizations of our characters or of people as just this binary good or bad, but we recognize that there's this almost beautiful, if you will, mixture of both. And all of this is relevant to our students and the authors that they read. I want to take a look at a quote that Calvin has. Calvin talks about the liberal arts in his magnum opus, the Institutes of the Christian Religion. And under the things that he calls common, he also uses earthly and inferior to speak to the same category, he talks about liberal arts. And so liberal arts belong to this kind of common realm, this inferior earthly realm. And he says that this realm is the realm of pagans, but he also says that it is here that the full force of human acuteness is displayed. And if you can read this, I'll read along with you. He says that whenever we come upon these matters in secular writers, let that admirable light of truth shining in them teach us that the mind of man, though fallen and perverted from its wholeness, is nevertheless clothed and ornamented with God's excellent gifts. If we regard the Spirit of God as the sole fountain of truth, we shall neither reject the truth itself nor despise it wherever it shall appear, unless we wish to dishonor the Spirit of God. So, we assume, anthropologically speaking, that there's a lot of common grace that is bestowed upon people. And in general revelation, where most of our literature comes from, there's a lot of truth to be had, even if that truth is coming from outside of Scripture and outside of a believing worldview. And we'll touch on this more later. But it speaks to specific competencies that different people have. So, Hemingway is not competent to speak authoritatively about the church and about spiritual things. But he's wildly insightful and almost prophetic when he's speaking of things earthly. So that's a freedom that we have and an assumption that we have as we interact with literature. Relatedly, part of our brokenness is that we demonstrate day in and day out a habit of having epistemic humility. We recognize that our knowledge is analogous to God's knowledge. It is not the same. We do not know things the way that God knows them. He has created us as creatures, and he remains the creator. And so his access to truth is that as one who has created all things. And ours, we are striving constantly as broken people with affected noetically by the fall to strive to know. And so we realize that our perceptions are failing, that our sin gets in the way, that we have all kinds of cognitive biases that are part of our nature. And so we struggle to know, but we struggle to know hopefully, knowing that there is truth out there to know. So while special revelation is always primary and normative for us, literature deals with, as Calvin said, the realm of natural revelation. And thus it's useful and good for us to engage with literature as a site of knowing God's naturally revealed truth. So here is a selection from Esther Meek. Meek is an author who we read as the students move from 10th to 11th grade over the summer. We read her Longing to Know, which is one of her kind of first introductory volumes to her epistemology. This is from her second volume, which is a much larger volume called Loving to Know. And she writes, even if we do not fully know the thing we long for, that is to say, the object of our knowing, we must also begin to live our lives on its terms. We show respect for it and submit to it. We can sustain such longing over moments or over years. It requires that we comport ourselves with patience and humility. We must wait and risk the waits issuing in nothing. We pledge ourselves to the yet to be known, living life on the terms of the longed for reality that calls for an attentiveness on our part that is far less like dispassionate cataloging of information and more like passionate indwelling of that half-hidden object of our care. And I think as we're talking about literature, you could substitute the object of knowing, the object of our care, as the truth that's revealed in the literature that we interact with. And then lastly, this resurrection bought freedom. So as part of a Christian school, we approach all things, our knowing endeavors, our learning endeavors, and indeed all of our curriculum, with the freedom that is granted by the centrality of the resurrection. You may think of 1 Corinthians 15, where Paul goes on at length talking about how our faith would be in vain if Christ was not raised, and he walks through that whole resurrection and what that means for us. And it isn't just that if Christ isn't raised, then everything is in vain. It's what follows from his definitely being raised. We are raised. And because of that, all else will be subjugated and destroyed, including death. That is indeed the good news, and that is the thing that sets us free. You may also think of Galatians 5:1, for freedom Christ has set us free, so on and so forth. But I figured we would interact with a little bit of Luther here. Taken from his treatise on Christian liberty, he writes at length, but I think powerfully, "It's evident that no external thing has any influence in producing Christian righteousness or freedom, or in producing unrighteousness or servitude. It does not help the soul if the body is adorned with the sacred robes of priests, or dwells in sacred places, or is occupied with sacred duties, or prays, fasts, abstains from certain kinds of food, or does any work that can be done by the body in the body. The righteousness and the freedom of the soul require something far different, since the things which have been mentioned could be done by any wicked person. Such works produce nothing but hypocrites. On the other hand, it will not harm the soul if the body is clothed in secular dress, dwells in unconsecrated places, eats and drinks as others do, does not pray aloud and neglects to do all of the above-mentioned things which hypocrites do." He goes on a little bit later, "One thing and one thing only is necessary for Christian life, righteousness and freedom. That one thing is the most holy word of God, the gospel of Christ. As Christ says in John 11, I am the resurrection of the life. He who believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. And then in John 8, so if the Son makes you free, you will be free indeed." And so we approach all of our literature in this freedom, that we can dwell in the secular places and wear secular garb and have it not stain the soul, as Luther says. Again, a significant takeaway, I think. So as we take on these ideas, worldviews, and controversies, we do so knowing that nothing unseats Christ and nothing stands in the way of the resurrection. And so we can play in dangerous spaces with combustible data, knowing that it doesn't affect us ultimately. So all of this has a lot of applications. And implications for our regular approach to literature, from choosing what books we're going to read to our discussion and assessments of those said books. These commitments form the foundational principles that give ideological life to the why of literature at TCS. All right, so we're going to talk about how we approach literature. First, we're going to talk about literature as artifact and then literature as experience. I rely on a lot of other people to talk about literature's experience, but it's one of my favorite things to talk about. So here's where we're just going to read a whole bunch of my favorite lines from scripture. Sorry, it's just going to happen. Because the first thing that we do, the primary interaction that we have with literature as artifact, is the literature as a text in and of itself. All right, it is a text that speaks, and it is a text that is often beautiful, which is to say that anytime we are reading, usually the first thing that strikes us with great literature is an aesthetic component, that it is indeed beautiful. It prompts us to wonder, to gaze at it. And at least I think these are some moments in the texts that we read where this happens. So first, Moby Dick, which we read in 10th grade. This is my favorite chapter of the whole book, chapter 107. That's right, there's more than 107 chapters, and I have to wait until 107 every time to get to my favorite chapter. And it opens this way. It's called The Carpenter. Okay, so it's talking about the carpenter. Seat thyself sultanically among the moons of Saturn and take high abstracted man alone. And he seems a wonder, a grandeur, and a woe. But from the same point, take mankind in mass. And for the most part, they seem a mob of unnecessary duplicates, both contemporary and hereditary. But most humble though he was, and far from furnishing an example of the high humane abstraction, the Pequod's carpenter was no duplicate. Hence, he now comes in person on this stage. Or perhaps The Great Gatsby, which I just finished up with the 11th graders. Every year I get very excited about it. I may even, we were talking about vulnerability and shame today in our assembly, and I may get a little vulnerable about my relationship with The Great Gatsby a little bit later on, we'll see. The two sections that I have from Gatsby are taken from the second page and the last page. So I'm giving you bookends here, and I don't think I'm spoiling too much. If you haven't read The Great Gatsby, you need to read it. It's not just the cliche book that high schoolers read. It's a beautiful, beautiful book. Okay, first, no, Gatsby turned out all right at the end. It is what preyed on Gatsby. What foul dust floated in the wake of his dreams that temporarily closed out my interest in the abortive sorrows and short-winded elations of men. Just thinking right now, I didn't put it on the slide, but one of my favorite lines in all of literature happens just a couple paragraphs above this, where our narrator, Nick Carraway, says that reserving judgments is a matter of infinite hope. Whew, beautiful. And then the end. Its vanished trees, the trees that had made way for Gatsby's house, had once pandered in whispers to the last and greatest of all human dreams. For a transitory enchanted moment, man must have held his breath in the presence of this continent, compelled into an aesthetic contemplation he neither understood nor desired, face to face for the last time in history with something commensurate to his capacity for wonder. We don't read East of Eden, but I really, really like this passage. So just read it. I don't know. Someday we'll read East of Eden when we have time. This comes from part 4, chapter 34. It's really great, but I'm going to skip it for the sake of time. Sorry. Brave New World. We also read this in 11th grade. It was the sort of idea that might easily decondition the more unsettled minds among the higher castes, make them lose their faith in happiness as the sovereign good, and take to believing instead that the goal was somewhere beyond, somewhere outside the present human sphere, that the purpose of life was not the maintenance of well-being, but some intensification and refining of consciousness, some enlargement of knowledge. Heaven forbid. And in this line, we always play with a little bit. It's simple. A look from Mustafa Mond reduced him to an abject silence. And yet I spend some time with this line. Some humanities teachers were recently talking, and we were talking about how really it's one of the jobs of the humanities teacher to problematize and make complex the seemingly simple. And this is a seemingly simple sentence, and yet I think it's one of the coolest uses of an indefinite article that I've ever interacted with. Because this sentence could just as easily say that a look from Mustafa Mond reduced him to abject silence, kind of describing his reaction. But instead, it actually ontologically changes Bernard here that he becomes an abject silence. He switches as a noun. He becomes something else through this look. And so we spend some time looking at the power of an indefinite article. And because of the work in the grammar school and elsewhere, I mean, they could diagram it and other things as well. I try not to do that because I don't want to look too stupid. Thank you for laughing at that, Russ. Why are you laughing at that? Okay, thank you. All right, so some beautiful moments in literature. We look at literature as a cultural and historical artifact as well. I mentioned Gatsby because Gatsby is such a perfect example. I want to give you a sense of what we do in 11th grade so you can get a sense of maybe some of the ways in which we're a little bit different. The way we approach, for example, American literature, which is the literature that they study in 11th grade, corresponds with their American history class and with my other contemporary rhetorics class where we do a lot about American identity, civic life, national parks, memorials, all these things. And it, of course, corresponds to their trip to D.C. at the end of the year. But in that class, we begin by talking about William Bradford's journal that he keeps as he is immigrating to the United States from Holland. And he keeps this kind of memoir of a kind when he originally arrives on Plymouth Plantation. And he, like all of his other Puritan settlers, are thinking that this is the promised land. We talk about this at length, and I won't explain too much of it here, but he and John Winthrop, for example, both kind of take on this covenant of works language. They're almost like Israel going into the promised land, saying, all this we will do, which is problematic for a whole host of theological reasons. But they get there, and things don't quite work out for them initially, as you all know from your American history classes that weren't that many years ago, I'm sure. And so, of course, because they've taken on this language, the covenant works, they think that, well, they must have done something wrong, because otherwise, why would we being cursed presently? And so he writes this, and it almost becomes this Jeremiad of a kind, where he has this great American dream that has this kind of theological orientation, and it just kind of is undermined. And it's a really telling work that kind of sets the path for a lot of American literature. And it just so happens that the motif that is used over and over again, and even in the text that we read from The Great Gatsby, which is written in 1925, a number of years later, it parallels that kind of commensurate capacity for wonder. Remember when they beheld the land? It explicitly references the Dutch immigrants. And so the way that we look at The Great Gatsby, we kind of follow both of these timelines, the 20th century and 17th century, and we look at them as essentially doing the same work, keeping a journal of the American dream and how one is interacting with that dream and having access to it or not having access to it. And it's interesting to look at that kind of the cultural and historical context that gives rise to a more deep and robust understanding. So even if in another American literature class people were willing to kind of explore theoretically, they're referencing the pilgrims here, the Dutch immigrants, and they're making this analogy. Our students are rooted in the text that I think it could have in mind. And so we're reading this kind of parallel together to say that this text that's written in the 17th century has a lot to say about life in America in the 1920s. And then we look at the work of The Great Gatsby as its own situation in the 1920s. And we can take a look, for example, it's got this great, it actually has a song, a pop song in it. How unique is that to have a piece of literature that has a pop song in it? And so it has this song, Ain't That Fun, by Venk and Scheck or something like that. We play the song, we dance to it, it's a great time. It's in the text of The Great Gatsby, which of course immediately dates it. But for us, it's this insight into history. And then there's some other clever things that the narrator is doing there, because the song itself is about the kind of futility of money and how important it is to just enjoy one another. And the chorus is that we don't have money. And yet it's used in Gatsby, ironically, to kind of undermine Gatsby's pursuit of wealth at the cost of all else and all of his relationships. So we see all of these kind of moments, and we read 1920s poetry alongside of it. Edna St. Vincent Millay, for example, has some beautiful poetry, First Fig, Second Fig, that speak to this time as the candle is burning from both ends. Burning the midnight oil is a phrase that she makes very popular in her 1920s poetry. So all this to say, it's this beautiful insight into the time, the 1920s,
But also we allow other times to speak to it, and we allow it to speak to other times. And so we also don't just treat it as a 17th century text or a 20th century text, but a 21st century text. How does it speak today in some profound ways? There are more obvious examples. Ninth grade, for example, medieval literature. We could look at Augustine working between the space of the fall of Rome and the medieval church. Get a lot of historical information from that. We could look at Jonathan Swift satirizing Enlightenment thought in Gulliver's Travels. Newly, we've added Fatima Mirza's work, A Place for Us, in 11th grade American Lit. That was a work just published a year or two ago now. And she provides this beautiful insight into the complicated family dynamics that many of us experience, and then furthermore, this immigrant experience in a modern American culture. We could also look at The Crucible, which we also read in 11th grade, as insight not just into the Salem witch trials, but also into the Red Scare era, which is what, of course, he meant that to do. So, of course, these are selective insights, but they're formative ones, since culture speaks loudly to our perspectives on history. So we spend a lot of time there. Also, we have to keep in mind that a lot of this literature shapes not just our perspectives on history, but our general attitude for the past and even coming generations. I like to think of, you likely know this, that the Christmas Carol essentially built the basis for the way that we understand the kind of aesthetic Christmas experience as we have it today. There are sixth graders interact with that work, and it kind of blows their mind to realize that, you know, in a lot of ways, Charles Dickens created, Norman Rockwell created so much of our Christmases. Not in California, of course. I'm from the Midwest, so I know what Christmas looks like. So we look at these texts as these incredibly formative moments. Related to this, we spend a lot of time, again, in 11th grade, I'll talk about some of the other grades more in a minute, looking at literary critical models. So we spend some time in literary criticism by the time they get to 11th grade. I think that's probably developmentally appropriate. Right now, I'm going to add a couple more to it this year, but right now what we've done for the last few years is we've taken a look at feminist, psychoanalytic, and Marxist criticism. And essentially the way that we approach this is essentially like glasses that we can put on safely and take off. And all we're looking for is as much explanatory data as we can possibly get from a text. We're looking for not just this explanatory power that each one has, but also thinking about the historical resources that were available to authors. And so if somebody is writing during the kind of heightened craze of Marxism in the 20th century, then it's quite possible, and in fact even likely, that looking at it through some of these Marxist questions is going to reveal a whole lot of data that we might not otherwise have. One of the more obvious examples is taking a look at, and we just started this book this week, William Faulkner's The Sound and the Fury. And to be able to look at that work through a kind of psychoanalytic lens is almost necessary because Sigmund Freud is kind of at the height of his powers while this literature is being written. And there are so many assumptions that Faulkner makes that we have to draw on this if we're to kind of understand more of what he's doing. So this provides an occasion to read texts the way the world and others might, without being beholden to any particular model. This goes back to the freedom that we have. And to be clear, our adopting of these positions merely provide questions to ask of a text. They don't require us to take on the worldview, of course. So, for example, here are a couple of questions we might ask of a text. The psychoanalytic criticism, these are general questions. I take this from Lois Tyson's work, Critical Theory Today, or something like that. I think it's in your slides. The first one, what unconscious motives are operating in the main characters? What core issues are thereby illustrated? And how do these core issues structure or inform the piece? Or the Marxist question, how does the literary work reflect, intentionally or not, the socioeconomic conditions of the time in which it was written or set? And what do those conditions reveal about the history of class struggle? One of the best critical readings of The Great Gatsby I've read has been a Marxist critique of it, to think about the way it speaks to the commodification of people in that work. And if you've read the work, I think that's a pretty obvious point, but it's great that it gives us vocabulary to kind of pull this out. And then finally, and in some ways most profoundly for me, we read texts as a rhetorical artifact. We begin with an assumption that any work of fiction is a text with designs on attitudes, actions, and or beliefs. These designs are intentional or unintentional, and they are comprised of choices made by the author in light of a horizon of available resources. So the way that I talk to my students is that every author has this horizon of resources, whether it's the way that they structure their novel, the characters that they have, the settings that they place it in. And at various points in history, due to various circumstances, some resources are more available than at other times. So we don't expect Hamlet, for example, to involve himself in pure stream of consciousness thought, the way that William Faulkner is going to use with the advent of Freudian subconscious psychology. However, that resource is available to Shakespeare, and Hamlet's soliloquies, to be or not to be, are a kind of anticipation of stream of consciousness narration. So it's not modern, but it sounds an awful lot like modernism. That resource is just more brightly lit, so to speak, on the horizon of William Faulkner's day. And so we spend time thinking about this choice, intentional or not, and how it has designs on our attitudes, actions, or beliefs. That is kind of the work of rhetoric. So the way that this can look, I wanted to read James Phelan. James Phelan is this great scholar whose work I'd recommend. A lot of it is available online for free. He doesn't publish it anymore. I forget which university he's at presently, but he was a student of Wayne Booth. Wayne Booth, some of you may know, largely responsible, him and a cohort, of starting the Chicago literary criticism model, because he was at University of Chicago when he was alive, again, early 20th century, early to mid 20th century. Great scholar, really, really great writer. He's got some beautiful essays and things too. I'd commend his works to you all. James Phelan was his student who kind of brought a lot of his ideas along in some really compelling ways. And so I rely on Wayne Booth, James Phelan, and a couple of other people to kind of put a lot of this together. And Phelan writes that the goal of rhetorical reading is to illuminate the potential for productive, multi-layered communicative exchanges between implied authors and actual audiences. And its strategy is to respect the implied author and the novel without unduly disrespecting or over-respecting them. In this sense, rhetorical reading's chief ethical value is justice. Rhetoric and ethics have a long history of being wedded together. And here he says that even in our reading rhetorically of a text, there's a certain kind of justice that is demanded of us from the text, which is interesting. I'm thinking of this now, that Elaine Scarry's work on beauty and being just, which we read in 12th grade in our ethics and aesthetics class, she writes this work on aesthetics that I like so much because she roots the aesthetic experience in an ethical experience. And she says, really, our looking at beauty is really just a matter of justice. We are just giving the object of our gaze what it is due for being beautiful. And it speaks back to us. And so there's this really great kind of ethical, virtuous foundation to the way that we understand things. And maybe we could look at that here, too, since we talked about text as aesthetic artifact earlier. So we start with our rhetorical reading in ninth grade when they take rhetoric proper. In fact, we're doing that right now with the ninth graders. So if you have a ninth grader, you know a ninth grader, you can start asking them some of these questions. I won't get into everything that we talk about, but we start to talk about some of the techniques that authors can use in order to kind of communicate, again, have some kind of either argument presented, a worldview kind of presented from the text, or to have these kind of designs on our attitudes, actions, or beliefs through the choices that they make. And one of the things that we spend a lot of time on in ninth grade is narrator. And so you have this in your, you don't have to actually see any of this. This is, again, taken from a couple of different works. It is by no means original to me. And in fact, my former professor, Glenn McClish, did a lot of this and some of my other colleagues in that program. But we have, in ninth grade, we learned 25 different kinds of narrators. And each narrator is accomplishing something slightly different, slightly unique. I challenge you to find other schools that are looking at 25 different narrators. And more than that, the students really realize the impact that these narrators have and that these subtle choices make. So if we read, for example, The Lottery by Shirley Jackson, perhaps you know this story, it ends rather tragically, and it's a number 25 narrator, which is the most cinematic of narrators. There's no commenting at all. And so when this tragedy happens in the story and it goes uncommented on, It's this like beautiful moment where we have to then do the work of commenting. It draws the reader in even more. We have to do more work because the narrator has done essentially no work. And it's almost scandalous, right? So read the work. It's challenging. I wouldn't read it for bedtime reading, but it's really compelling. And then ask yourself, what would it have looked like had, for example, one of the main characters of the town told the story from their perspective? So the difference between, for example, a number one narrator and a number 25 narrator, the difference is huge. There's a reason that Jackson chooses to do that. Okay, by the time we get to 11th grade, we complicate things wildly. I'll say kind of for the sake of time that what you see up here is a good representation. This is taken from one of the worksheets that I pass out. This is now largely James Phelan's work and just my kind of visual representation and summary of it. We make these interpretive, ethical, and aesthetic judgments, and we talk about textual dynamics and these readerly dynamics and how it spurs us on to read more. And you can look at the slide there. But we spend a lot of time treating texts as rhetorical artifacts. I'm not going to read all of these quotes here. They're a little lengthy. Martha Nussbaum just really writes some beautiful things here. So read it. What I will say is that she has that kind of opening line that we have never lived enough. She quotes Aristotle there. You could just read Aristotle's Poetics for some of this as well. We've never lived enough. Our experience is, without fiction, too confined and too parochial. Literature extends it, making us reflect and feel about what might otherwise be too distant for feeling. She talks at length about the power of novels to extend our experiences. I'm going to skip to a slide that may not be in all of your handouts because I added it this morning. And I think it's a more kind of lay summary of what Nussbaum speaks to. So this is from Alain de Botton, who runs the School of Life. He's a therapist and philosopher and just kind of a public thinker. And he writes this. He writes, literature speeds up years. It can take us through a whole life, a decade per chapter in a day. And so lets us study the long-term consequences of decisions that in our own lives work themselves out with dangerous slowness. We have a chance to see accelerated form what can happen when you worry only about art and not so much about money, or only about ambition and not so much about your own children. What happens when you despise ordinary people or are disturbingly concerned with what others think? Literature can help us avert mistakes. All those heroes who commit suicide, those unfortunate demented souls who murder their way out of trouble, or the victims who die of loneliness in unfurnished rooms are trying to teach us things. Literature is the very best reality simulator we have, a machine which, like its flight equivalent, allows us safely to experience the most appalling scenarios that it might, in reality, might have taken many years and great danger to go through, in the hope that we'll be ever so slightly less inclined to misunderstand ourselves, swerve blindly into danger, and unleash catastrophes. My own summary goes something like this. Literature is a kind of dress rehearsal where we can work through different experiences, both foreign and familiar, reflect on characters and our own motivations, and work through possible consequences with a clarity that is offered only in rehearsal. We don't have an audience. Our deliberations are not especially costly. Right or wrong, we are so in community, a community comprised of fellow broken image bearers and a Christian educator whose only hope in life and in death is the life, death, and resurrection of Christ and his promised return. Therefore, we can model bold freedom as we play with ideas, wear interpretive masks, and embrace our own creatureliness and all the humility that that reality demands. But this community is also comprised of the characters we meet in the books we befriend throughout the year. They are our conversation partners and instructors, and like good friends, they provide occasions for us to grow in experience, wisdom, and virtue. That idea of treating texts as friends, and I'm recognizing my time is drawing to a close here, and yet I'm still going to be vulnerable for a second. When we finished up The Great Gatsby this year, I got teary at the end of it. And it's not just because the last page is so beautiful, but because for the first time, I think, with that work, I really felt like I was saying goodbye to a friend. Wayne Booth talks about this in the work called The Company We Keep. He talks about the metaphor he uses to talk about literature is a friend of ours. And I felt that. I felt like I was saying goodbye to the text. I had enjoyed it so much again. And I enjoyed it so much with this particular group of students. And it was just this beautiful experience. And it was difficult for me to say goodbye to it. And I even talked to a student later who I caught reading the book well after we were done with it. It was just last week and we had moved on past it. And I asked him what he was doing. He's why I'm reading it again. And he said, I'm going to probably read it again before the year gets out, just maybe two more times. I think he felt the same way that I did. It's difficult to say goodbye to these beautiful friends that teach us so much. Okay, so I'm going to kind of move through this pretty quickly. And then if there are further questions, you know, we can, again, we can stick around if you don't want to learn about sex or technology. But I just want to talk a little bit about the way that we choose books. So I've chosen most of the books. We've made some adjustments throughout the years, but in the upper school. And typically how I do this is I consult pretty much every encyclopedic reference that I can, from Norton to the Cambridge and Oxford compendiums for the different kind of literature that we're studying, whether it's early modern, European, or American, world lit, whatever else. And I try to kind of pick the most representative works that we can get through, the larger novels, and then some selections of a bunch of the other ones. I also consult, but don't particularly care about College Board. They have a good list, though, and I recently went through College Board's list of books, and we read about 90% of what they recommend, and then we read things beyond it as well. So choosing books, you know, kind of at a pragmatic level, that's how I would work through that. I thought I'd introduce Leland Ryken's categories. He's from Wheaton, a pretty important Christian thinker. Many of you are probably familiar with him. But he says that there are kind of three categories of literature, and he's coming at this from this kind of Christian liberal arts perspective. He says first that there is Christian literature. This is the literature that echoes scripture explicitly. Most of this we see in our medieval literature class in ninth grade. Note that not all Christian authors are making Christian literature, like John Updike, for example. He would fit into that category. Then secondly, there's the literature of common human experience. This is the literature that shines light on penultimate realities, or this kind of earthly or common realm, like Calvin would say it, in ways that are common to all people. It gives an accurate, if metaphysically and theologically incomplete, view of reality. This is the vast majority of the literature that we interact with at Cambridge. This is Faulkner, this is Frost, this is Dickens, so on. And then finally, there's the literature of unbelief. An OPC minister and the president of White Horse Inn, who you might be familiar with, his name is Mark Green. He describes authors in this category as, quote, unknowingly bearing witness to the beauty of the created world while raising metaphorical fists toward their creator. He suggests that this is where the majority of our neighbors and many artists live and move and have their being. So we also interact with this category. This would include many of the romantic poets and authors like Kurt Vonnegut, James Joyce, George Orwell. Here's how I feel about the categories. I think they're helpful. I don't think that they're kind of the ultimate reality. I think they're a little leaky. And so I'm a little slow to ascribe value to them. So in a community like this, we may prefer the category of Christian literature, perhaps. But what happens if the theology of that Christian literature is wrong? Maybe the ransom theory of atonement in the Narnia series. That could be just as problematic as the literature of unbelief or common literature. Maybe Dante's Purgatory, also problematic, despite the fact that it fits into that first category of literature. And also, we have Christian authors that write commonly all the time, like Updike or Tolstoy or others. And the literature of unbelief sometimes is a better lens on common realities than most. I would argue that Kurt Vonnegut understands the wickedness of war, human nature, and suffering better than most, just like Huxley and Orwell are seen as prophets in our modern day. I have a longer quote here taken from this book, Art and Morality. It's hard to find, so I'm happy to make copies if you're interested in this article. I'll leave you to read it, that talks about why we might read kind of immoral literature. And if you didn't get a handout, I've got, there looks like there's a couple more back there, but I can always print more for you and you can take a look at this. But he makes the case for interacting with this kind of literature. I think you've already gotten a sense that, you know, it's heavily integrated. It speaks to our history. It speaks to the rhetoric classes. It speaks to the science classes at times. And we let those other disciplines speak to us as well. So we spend a lot of time with integration. You probably know from our curriculum, especially those of you in the grammar stage, we continue this in the upper school, that we are very chronologically, historically situated, and even kind of geographically as well. And so we'll work through historically, despite the fact that we're using two timelines, but nevertheless, historically, chronologically, American literature, for example. Ninth grade would be this kind of emphasis on medieval lit. But sometimes also we categorize it somewhat thematically. And so, for example, in seventh grade, the students learn Joseph Campbell's hero's journey. And so we pick stories that specifically kind of either use or subvert that that model of understanding narrative. And then I complicate that further in ninth and then further in 11th grade. So we have this kind of like thematic integration. Our discussion, our classes are very discussion heavy. I do, and I know my fellow faculty members do, a lot of reading in class to be able to model good reading, to tell good story, to be able to stop when you sense that students have something to say about it. So rather than just assigning them a bunch of work at home to do, we spend a lot of time reading a diverse set of texts in class. And just keep in mind that we kind of opened with the Christian education distinctives, and that breathes life into a lot of what we do in literature, from the readings that we choose to our goals and pedagogy. We're not driven by College Board. We're not driven by AP testing. What we're driven by is a love of humanity and the desire to cultivate more of that, to extend the experiences of our inexperienced students, to engage them in conversation as a peer who is interacting around a text as a friend, that we can learn something from, even the worst of literature, morally speaking, we can learn something from it. And indeed, we can even save students in a lot of ways from having to experience those things themselves. They have a framework, they have a structure to be able to think through these problems in ways. So, I write here that we look at literature the way that ancients looked at literature, as secondhand experiences that are sites of virtue cultivation. So hopefully that gives you a good sense. I'm just 4 minutes over of what we do here, maybe why we do it. I think many significant distinctives that exist in the literature program here at Cambridge. And I would love to hear more questions if you all stick around with me for the next bit. So thank you.
Thanks for listening to An Examined Education. Be sure to subscribe so that you never miss an episode. And if you like what you hear, be sure to check out our website, schedule a tour, reach out to the advancement office. We'd love to see you. And we'd love to hear what you have to say about the podcast. So be sure to check us out on your favorite social media platform. Again, that's at An Examined Education. Leave us a comment, rate and review, and we'll see you next time.